Jaws Foreign Minister says positive developments in JCPOA revival talks in Vienna do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. To jab or not to jab, opponents and supporters of COVID vaccine mandates hold rallies in several cities across Canada. And a tragic end to days-long rescue operations in Morocco. Rescuers take out the lifeless body of a 5-year-old boy trapped in a deep well. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. Iran says there have been positive developments in JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they still do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a telephone conversation with the European Union's Foreign Policy Chief, Josep Borrell. He says the 2015 deal has not had any economic benefits for Iran in years. Amir Abdollahian said that Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal which would guarantee Iran's economic benefits in a reliable and sustainable manner. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories have been engaged in talks in Vienna at reviving the accord. In the latest developments, Washington has announced the restoration of a sanctions waiver, but Iranian officials say the U.S. should show its goodwill in practice by removing all its anti-Iran sanctions. Earlier, we reached out to history professor and political commentator David Yahubian to get his comments on these developments. Now, he says that JCPOA would only be revived if it benefits Iran economically.
Amir Abdollahian is, of course, stating and repeating the obvious, that it's only going to be verifiable and sustainable sanctions relief that brings Iran fully back into accordance with the JCPOA if it can be saved. And the State Department release is very specific. It says that this is not a quid pro quo, that this does not necessarily benefit Iran, but it explicitly says that even if the JCPOA is not returned to fully, if both sides don't return to full implementation, and I'm closely paraphrasing here, it will still assist us in our non-proliferation efforts. Therefore, this potentially benefits the United States if the JCPOA is not returned to. It does indeed facilitate the ultimate return to full implementation by both sides, and therefore, to Amir Abdollahian's point, it's still moving in the right direction, but no, indeed, this doesn't provide Iran with anything, and what Iran is looking for is verifiable, sustainable sanctions relief. Even a full year after Donald Trump pulled out in May of 2018, Iran maintained all of its commitments under the agreement, despite the fact that it never achieved the goal of the agreement for Iran in the first place, which was sanctions relief. So thankfully, I think we're at a point where the Iranian negotiating team, quite seasoned and quite skilled regarding the various tricks and shenanigans, if you will, that the United States is going to try to pull off here. We're either going to return to a JCPOA that benefits Iran economically, or we will not be returning to the agreement.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says all regional problems and issues can be resolved if foreign powers stop interventions. In a phone call with the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadimi, Iran's president said problems in the region are due to the excessive demands of the U.S. He added, if Americans are literally expelled from West Asia, then regional countries will fully establish peace, stability, and security through cooperation. Raisi also said Iraq has a significant position in Iran's policy with regard to the development of neighborly and regional relations. Al-Khadimi also welcomed Iran's approach in the expansion of neighborly interactions. He expressed hope for deeper bilateral ties and cooperation. Saudi warplanes have carried out over 30 fresh airstrikes across Yemen. Provinces of Sana'a, Sada, Jaf, and Hajjah have been targets. There's no word yet on casualties. The Saudi Arabia and its allies have been ramping up, that is, their aggression against Yemen in recent weeks. The Yemeni army is responding with cross-border retaliatory strikes inside the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. It says it will continue these operations until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war comes to an end. U.S. administration has changed hands between Democrats and Republicans since the outbreak of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in early 2015. But no matter which government holds the reins, U.S. sticks to the same policies. And now 7 years on, the U.S. continues to provide the coalition with unwavering military and diplomatic support, making itself complicit in Yemen's war crimes. In this report, we'll review how three U.S. administrations missed chances to end one of the world's bloodiest wars.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians, because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If they the United States will continue, or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
A days-long rescue operation for a 5-year-old Moroccan boy, Ryan, who has been trapped down a well, has come to a tragic end as his lifeless body has been finally pulled up. Now, firefighters have been working for the past 5 days in a risky earth-moving operation. The pace of drilling slowed in the final few hours to avoid any vibrations which would send the flimsy structure of the well collapsing. Rescue teams have been providing the boy with food, water, and oxygen through a tube, and Ryan was alive just until a few hours until the end of this rescue operation. Ryan was playing near a well Tuesday before he fell into the 32-meter deep hole. The U.S. is deploying additional troops to Europe as a standoff between the West and Russia intensifies over Ukraine. The first batch of American soldiers landed in Poland shortly after the arrival of senior U.S. commanders. Polish Army spokesman says the bulk of contingent of 1,700 U.S. soldiers will soon be coming. President Joe Biden is sending nearly 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania. Washington says the move is aimed at shielding Eastern Europe in the face of a potential spillover from the Ukraine crisis. U.S. and its allies have accused Russia of amassing over 100,000 troops along its border with Ukraine in preparation for an invasion. Moscow denies that allegation and says it is strongly opposed to increased military activity by the U.S. and NATO near its border. Tensions are still high between Russia and the West over Ukraine, and despite talks held in previous weeks to try to defuse them, U.S. and its NATO allies insist that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine and is providing pretext for that. Russia denies any such plan and instead has complained about increased military activity by NATO near its border. Even Ukraine has called on the West not to stir up panic. So why is the West still taking this stance?
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a U.S. ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the U.S. continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there, Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 that started, you know, was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. In Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters. That, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli, that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, the short answer to this is it's called misdirection, or projection as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate the pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded.
Since taking office in January of last year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has exerted pressure on Russia and China. It's imposed rounds of sanctions on both countries over various issues. The result, the two Eastern superpowers are inching closer to each other. They promised to boost cooperation, including on plans to use their national currencies to trade instead of the U.S. dollar.
China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We here at RIB English Radio congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Islamic Revolution, a new Islamic civilization. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The statement of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, which was issued by the leader on the 40th anniversary of the victory of the revolution, was indeed the upper hand document of establishing the new Islamic civilization. Among the oppressed nations, few stage a revolution. And among those which do so, few have managed to finish the job. In other words, among those few nations which have changed the ruling system, very few have successfully kept the ideals of revolution in the face of hostilities and plots. But the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian nation was an exception in this regard. It has been the most popular revolution of not the 20th century, but several centuries. Therefore, it has boastfully insisted on its ideals, despite 43 years of ceaseless hostility and conspiracy of enemies. The Islamic Revolution terminated the long history of decadence. Iran had been humiliated during various kingdoms, particularly the Qajarid and Pahlavi rules. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the backwardness of Iran during the Pahlavi regime, "Before the rule of Islam in this country, we were a backward nation in the full sense of it. We were dependent, politically backward, scientifically backward, socially backward, and isolated in the world of politics. Today, the progresses of the Islamic Republic have urged even our enemies to admit. Today, in the scientific ranking, in the technological ranking, in many modern sciences of the world, we are at the grade of advanced countries. The Islamic Ummah, with a strenuous and serious effort, can design the Islamic civilization of this era to set its foundations, to make it flourish and put it forward before the eyes of mankind." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, introducing the Islamic civilization, says, "In the new Islamic civilization, the spirituality stands beside material issues and ethics. Spirituality is beside the progress of material life." Ayatollah Khamenei further explains that the new Islamic civilization consists of two parts, namely instrumental and real. The instrumental part includes the values that we consider as progress, such as sciences, inventions, industry, politics, economy, political and military might, international position, etc. The real part of the civilization consists of lifestyle and whatever shapes our life, like family, way of marriage, kind of house, type of clothing, consumption pattern, kinds of food, cuisine, entertainment, job and employment, way of conduct at work, behavior in university, school and the media, behavior with friends, enemies and foreigners. According to the Quran, material and spiritual growth will come to existence once the society and individuals move in the way of God. In view of this, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, introduced monotheism as the core of his mission. The knowing of prophethood, which comes after monotheism, also means knowing the Islamic unity and civilization. The Prophet founded the Islamic unity and civilization and fulfilled many social, cultural, political, and economic changes to set the ground for establishment of a glorious global civilization in a short period. Thus, the monotheistic Ummah and the Islamic civilization thereof are based on the rule of Allah. Ayatollah Khamenei, stressing this issue, maintains that the society based on monotheism will achieve all beliefs which the Islamic civilization brings about. According to verse 257 of chapter Baqarah of the Quran, "Allah is the guardian of the faithful. He brings them out of darkness into light." Thus, the reality of the Islamic civilization is to get distant from darkness and entering light. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "The world of Islam today is duty-bound to breathe the spirit in this world, like Islam itself and the Prophet himself, to create a new atmosphere, to open a new way. We call this phenomenon, which we are waiting for, as the new Islamic civilization. We should pursue the new Islamic civilization for mankind. This basically differs from what the powers are thinking and doing for mankind. It does not mean capturing lands. It does not mean transgressing upon the rights of nations. It does not mean imposing one's ethics and culture on other nations. It means to present the divine gift to nations so that nations, through their free will, through their choice, and through their distinguishing, choose the right way. The way towards which today the world powers have taken nations is a wrong and a straight way. This is our duty today. Dear friends, the victory of the Islamic Revolution and emergence of the Islamic Iran as a powerful country challenging the very existence of big powers has made it possible to found a new Islamic civilization. Ayatollah Khamenei says unity is not a political and tactical move. It is rather a heartfelt belief and faith in the necessity of the unity of the Islamic Ummah. The first step in the unity of the Islamic Ummah is for the Muslim communities, governments, ethnicities, and denominations to refrain from aggressing on and striking one another to get united against the common enemy. And in the next steps, the Islamic countries should have synergy and make effort together in sciences, riches, security, and political power in order to reach the new Islamic civilization. The Islamic Revolution is marking its 43rd anniversary. Although the enemies of this revolution have incessantly schemed innumerable plots since the birth of this revolution to destroy it, it has stood tall in the world and kept inspiring new generations to withstand big powers with the hope in a bright future in which there would be no place for the global arrogance symbolized in the US and the fabricated Zionist regime of Israel.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haidar. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having us.
So, really interesting question today, and it's about the Islamic Republic of Iran. Is it a model? Can it be a model? I mean, it's rising out of the flames of the hegemony of the Western powers and the Eastern powers as well. It's becoming this independent, free state. So, the question is this. Can it become a model for other Muslim countries and perhaps even the world? And I'm going to go to Sayyid Mahdi first.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thanks again for having us on the program. Before I answer that question, there was one thing that I wanted to bring up. In a previous program, we had talked about atomic weapons, you know, and this idea that the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that the production and keeping and using these nuclear weapons is haram. It is prohibited in Islam, and it is an un-Islamic thing. You know, before the world and this Western propaganda points a finger at the Islamic Republic for, you know, maybe in the future you might potentially have, you know, nuclear weapons. And I'm saying that because it's a might, potential, perhaps, maybe. you know, we don't want you to get close enough by this many yards. Okay, first of all, who's, like we had said, who are the countries who actually have nuclear weapons, right? So when you just look at the United States and Russia, these are two countries who have nuclear weapons in the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
In the thousands, huh? Not one. We all saw the damage that one nuclear weapon can have on an entire city of hundreds of thousands. And so here, the United States and Russia have each in the thousands of nuclear weapons. So they could destroy the whole world over if, you know, somebody crazy enough came into the government and had control over these things. And it's not just United States and Russia who has nuclear weapons. You see, Britain, France, China, India, Pakistan, these are all nuclear weapons countries. They have nuclear weapons. Most probably Israel and perhaps North Korea. These are countries that have nuclear weapons. And what's even more interesting is from all of these countries that have, so Russia has thousands of nuclear weapons, okay. But then when you actually ask the question on who used nuclear weapons, the only answer is the United States of America.
Yeah.
Who used nuclear weapons. It is the only country in the history of humanity that has used nuclear weapons, right? And not just once, but twice. Okay, so let's say that you say the first time they used it, it was a mistake, and they apologized, oh, crap, you know, this is a really serious weapon. It can destroy hundreds and thousands of innocent civilians. No, after they dropped the first one, they dropped the second one. So even if the first one, for argument's sake, was a mistake, the second one was most definitely on purpose. And it was after witnessing the effects of the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So really, United States is where the whole world should be pointing their finger to. And be like, hey, why do you guys have nuclear weapons? You actually use them on people. You're the real threat to the world and security of the world. Not a country like the Islamic Republic who doesn't have weapons physically. You know, they don't religiously. They don't want to. They can't. They will not. They have chosen voluntarily because of the religion to not create or manufacture nuclear weapons. This is not a country that should be being taken out on the limelight. Just one quick thing, because this is really important. There's a lot of negative propaganda against the Islamic Republic, and that's why I wanted to bring it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, if you have the United States and you have Russia and you have Britain and you have France and you have China and you have India and you have Pakistan, most probably you have Israel, all of these guys have nuclear weapons. Is it not rational for other people to also want nuclear weapons to defend themselves? No, we'll get to not having it all. If the United States and all of these countries have nuclear weapons in the thousands, right, why should other countries who are really defenseless in front of a vast, you know, ammunition, a vast array of nuclear weapons, they should have nuclear weapons too to defend themselves. This is the rational thing to do, right? And here you find the opposite. No, no, we're going to have thousands of nuclear weapons. You can't have any.
Yeah.
Man, what kind of world are you guys living in?
Yeah, and it's the opposite. The Americans say, you know, we want Iran to behave like a normal country. What do you mean? Like, are you a normal country? America is not a normal country.
And so if yourself, and no. here's even the beauty of adding to what you said, right? That if you want Iran to behave like a normal country, and a normal country is the United States of America, well, okay, so then we should behave like a normal country and have nuclear weapons and drop nuclear weapons on other countries. You know, they don't know what to talk about. They don't know what their stance is. They have a weak foundation, and this is what causes trouble for them all across the world.
But Iran is not a normal country. Let's look at the realities. It is it's far from being a normal country. And actually, what Iran is essentially practically doing is providing a model for other Muslim countries to follow, and inshallah the world as well. This model of independence, of freedom, of resistance against the Taghut. Now, Sheikh Ali, is it actually a feasible model, or?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So basically what we want is a nuclear free world, right? Why? There's a rationale behind it. Not just the fatwas and the religious verdict, which is incumbent and mandatory on all Muslims, but in addition to that, we understand and realize that the detriments and the damages and the collateral damage of nuclear or atomic bombs. The world has seen it through the United States of America, you know, and we do understand it through research and scientific understanding of things, that there are going to be innocent people that will be killed, which Islam does not allow. So we have a very principled stance, and that is to free and rid the world of nuclear weapon. America must not have it. Israel, it's not a country, right? So whatever. But even other countries who claim to possess or do possess or are in the process of making the nuclear weapons, our stance, our religious, our humanitarian, and our you know, even national stance when it comes to the Islamic Republic of Iran is very clear. It is a nuclear-free world, not, as Sayyid pointed out, a discriminatory world where, you know, some countries have it and they bully other countries and the others don't have it.
Yeah, I just want to point out that that's about nuclear weapons, not nuclear energy. And I want to say this.
And we said it before, too, that nuclear energy is the right of every country, every nation.
Yes,
right?
I want to say that statement, which is attributed to the leader, because it's a beautiful statement. It summarizes this whole thought. He says that nuclear weapons for none, nuclear energy for all.
Awesome. So this is what our stance is, right? Now, in terms of it being a model, see, first we have to analyze and understand what the model is. And once we understand what the model is, your question will be answered automatically.
Yes.
What the Islamic Republic of Iran, which used to be Iran only before the revolution, the Islamic Revolution, what did it bring to the table? What is different about it? See, if you look at the nation, Iranian nation is the same Iranian nation that was in the time of Pahlavi and the Qajar regimes, right? It's the same Iranian nation. Now, you talk about Islamic scholars, they used to exist back in the day too. You talk about the Hoza, the Islamic seminary, it used to exist back in the day too. If you compare the shrines, the holy shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam and Hazrat Masuma alayhi salam, and also the Imamzadeh, right, the progeny and the sons of Imams, they used to exist back in the day too. So what really changed, right? This is what we need to understand. This is where what it funnels down to. We need to understand that Iran, the new Iran, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, has brought dignity, human dignity, back to where it should be. The national dignity back to where it should be. The scientific and the academic and knowledge development and advancement and progress back to where it should be for any nation. So once you see these things in the context of how the world was laid out and was divided in two camps, that is the East and the West, the Soviets and the Americans, Iran disturbed that equation. Iran is like, no one should be superior to other nation. And that is one of the things that if you notice throughout the past couple of decades, actually over a decade for sure, that the negotiation, the talks about negotiations took place between Iran and the United States of America. One thing was clear, and that was from Iran's side, that we will sit on the table, negotiation table with you if there are no preconditions. What gives you the right to put these preconditions before you can sit with us? You want to deal as a nation, consider us a nation, right? See how they brought back the human dignity and the national dignity back to the table? So now, if you ask anyone from any part of the world that how your nation should be treated by those who have more power in the world, they would say, we should be treated in a dignified way. So in one word, Iran brought back the dignity of not only Muslims, not only Shias, not only the followers of Ahlul Bayt, but the dignity of a human being, the dignity of a nation. So now, if you ask anyone, they would say, yep, we want that dignity. We want that respect. We want to have that self-respect, right? We shouldn't be bullied around. We shouldn't be told what to do. We shouldn't be controlled. We shouldn't be strong-armed, all of these things. So now, if I were to ask you, does that become a model for the rest of the nations? Hell yeah.
It should.
Right? Yeah. It makes sense. It's logical, right? Yeah. Independence from the clutches of the world imperialism and oppression. Right? So this is something that Iran revived, and this is what other nations like Venezuela, they are getting inspired because of. Right? Nations like Iraq, who were subjugated and who were suppressed for the longest time ever, they also wanted to copy this model. They wanted to follow this model.
Yes.
Just one last point is that when we talk about model, there are discussions which, of course, are beyond the scope of this this talk show or maybe this question.
Mm-hmm.
See, the Islamic Revolution, it brought back that centralization to the camp of the oppressed. This is how we need to look at it. It is not a revolution of a country. It is not a revolution of a people. Yes, Iranians are on the forefront, but it is a revolution of all the oppressed people,
mm-hmm.
right? It is the revolution that brought Islam, the pure Muhammadan Islam, which is global in nature. It's not regional. It's not country-based. It revived that pure Muhammadan Islam and brought it to the forefront,
yeah.
right? And this has become the hope. Now, based on this, what I just said, the new model that the world needs to focus on and, of course, discuss and understand, absorb, and digest is that we have a Hukumat-e-Islami, an Islamic government,
yeah.
right, which is based on ideology. And what is that ideology? That ideology is pure Muhammadan Islam.
Yeah.
This becomes that center point, and the rest of the oppressed, the rest of the justice seekers, the rest of the humanity needs to take it as a focus
yeah.
to stand up for building a good and a healthy world around them.
Yeah.
Right? So basically, Iran becomes that center, the Islamic leadership leads from the front, and rest follow.
Yeah.
Right? They get their dignity through association. Right? And this is exactly what the system of wilaya is. If you can just imagine a pyramid.
Mm.
At the top of the pyramid are those just people, you know, people like Imam Khamenei, people like Imam Khomeini, who are the true ambassadors of pure Muhammadan Islam. They lead from the front. Lead who? The followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that. They lead the entire camp of the oppressed, and they make and they team up against the oppressors of the world and give them a shut-up call. This is the model that is evolving, and this is the new Islamic civilization that is in the works.
That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed the show. From myself, from Sayyid Mehdi, from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please, don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, said recently that the Biden administration's views were negative about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline because it is seen as a geopolitical leverage which aims to divide Europe and undermine Europe's energy security. We're prepared for you an article written by Shervin Tahiri under the heading, Nord Stream 2 will divide Europe, entire West in half. Forget about the East and Western division of Europe. Nord Stream 2 pipeline will not only cut this continent, but the entire West into two halves. Perhaps we cannot say that all the current hype over the Ukraine crisis is an attempt to stop construction of this pipeline, which will give Moscow new leverage over the European Union. But one can say that stopping the Nord Stream 2 project is the main reason behind the current face-off between Washington and Moscow. American rulers, both Democrats and Republicans, are well aware that the economic logic of building this pipeline to transfer energy from natural gas fields in Russia's Yamal Peninsula near the Arctic Ocean to the northeastern coast of Germany in Greifswald via the Gulf of Finland and the Baltic Sea overshadows the military logic that seeks further extension of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO towards the east. The former president of the United States, Donald Trump, said in a recent interview that the pipeline was one of the dumbest moves I've ever seen and claimed that Germany would get over 70% of its energy from Russia. Donald Trump added, "And I'm the one that brought that up. Nobody ever knew about it. I used to talk about it all the time. Then they'd say, oh, he's weak on Russia." Putin would say, "You're killing me with this pipeline, but I got it stopped." As Donald Trump said, his administration approved sanctions against companies involved in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, but the administration of his successor, Joe Biden, suspended them. However, in 2020, not only most Democrats at the U.S. Congress joined Republicans in passing those sanctions, but Joe Biden himself announced that Nord Stream 2 is a bad deal for Germany, Ukraine and other U.S. allies in Eastern and Central Europe. Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, said last year that the Biden administration's views were negative about the pipeline because it is seen as a geopolitical leverage which aims to divide Europe and undermine Europe's energy security. The Biden administration, which had announced from the beginning that all companies involved in the project must withdraw as soon as possible, knew that imposition of serious sanctions against the pipeline must be avoided for a host of reasons. Finally, when Nord Stream 2 was completed in September, the White House decided to follow a multi-pronged policy to curb further development of Russia's energy policy in Europe. On the one hand, President Biden talked about getting along with this international and not simply Russian project, while on the other hand, he tried by stoking the crisis over Ukraine to threaten possible interests that Russia and its Eastern European allies could seek through development of this pipeline. By doing this, Joe Biden avoided the anger of his European allies who were fretting over increasing energy prices, while shunning the possibility of facing the wrath of major British and European energy companies that were involved in the Nord Stream 2 project. As a result, the Republicans decided to turn a blind eye to the role played by the energy giant Halliburton in the construction of this pipeline. Construction of Nord Stream 2 ended in September, and it was ready to be launched in the coldest months of the year in order to prevent a steep rise in the European Union's energy prices. Afterwards, Nord Stream 2 AG, the Russian company behind the project, decided to register its affiliates in Germany in order to start the legal steps needed for the inauguration of the pipeline. However, the new coalition government in Germany, headed by Chancellor Olaf Scholz, has refrained from licensing the project under pressure from the United States, NATO, and Ukraine. As a result, the consumer price of natural gas has greatly increased across Europe. Many experts believe that Germany's doodling for licensing this project is a result of the weak diplomacy followed by the country's new foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, who is greatly bent towards the United States. The German government previously alleged that the Russian company, which is totally owned by the country's energy giant Gazprom, has registered its affiliates in Switzerland and not Germany. In recent days, this excuse has been taken from the German government, and the geopolitical war between Russia and the United States has become more evident amid Europe's energy crunch. It is evident that the new coalition government in Berlin has decided to act more cautiously amid the ongoing geopolitical war in Europe. As a result, it has made the inauguration of Nord Stream 2 conditional on Russia avoiding military operations in Ukraine. At the same time, this policy will enable Germany to expect Russia return its favor in the near future, when Moscow is going to turn into the biggest energy supplier and possibly biggest trading partner of Berlin. The government of Germany's former Chancellor Angela Merkel opposed the suspension of the Nord Stream 2 project until its last days in office, despite the fact that her party, the Christian Democratic Union or CDU, was more closer to Washington than the existing ruling party, the Social Democratic Party SPD. Faced with demands to go along with Donald Trump's sanctions against a number of major Russian, European, and even American companies, Angela Merkel announced that Nord Stream 2 was a private sector project and that the German government would not interfere in its implementation. Of course, the US Democrats had hidden but more radical reasons to sanction companies involved in this project, because Nord Stream 2 was in every aspect similar to its predecessor, Nord Stream 1, which is the world's longest seabed gas transfer pipeline and was inaugurated back in 2011. Nord Stream 1 comprised of two parallel pipelines, 1,220 kilometers long and 1,220 millimeters in diameter, whose maximum annual capacity for gas supply from Russia to Europe was 55 billion cubic meters of natural gas. In the case of Nord Stream 1, only 30% of almost $15 billion investment in construction of land and seabed pipeline was made through stockholder companies, and the remaining 70% came from other sources. The lion's share of investment in Nord Stream 2 came through an international German banking network. Nord Stream AG is an international consortium of five major companies based in Zug, Switzerland, 51% of whose shares are owned by Russia's Gazprom. However, all its affairs are run from Gazprom headquarters in the northern district of St. Petersburg, Russia. Other oil and gas companies involved in the project include German, Dutch, and French energy firms, as well as German, Russian, Japanese, and Italian companies that specialize in laying pipelines on seabed. On the list of companies involved in this project, one can see major firms from Denmark, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Sweden, Spain, Norway, France, and Italy. This long list of major European energy firms involved in Nord Stream 2 project is enough to explain the confusion that the White House has been faced in its effort to prevent the completion of this international project. The US-based Halliburton and Intech Engineering are two major American energy corporations involved in the Nord Stream 2 project. Despite all the aforementioned facts, the Nord Stream 2 project is not actually new. Since the time of the former Soviet Union, that is, for more than half a century, Europe has been dependent on transfer of gas from Russia. Some experts even believe that the economic collapse of the Soviet Union was a result of a plot by then US President Ronald Reagan in the mid-1980s. Some 18 years ago, on 27th of February 2004, the Washington Post carried a report on the role of gas in the collapse of the Soviet Union and shed light on a plan by the US government to sabotage the eastward transfer of gas through the Soviet Union, Poland, and then East Germany to Western Europe. The report admitted that at the beginning of 1980s, Ronald Reagan put pressure on his Western European allies to prevent their participation in the construction of a gas pipeline from Russia, while at the same time drastically slashing West banking cooperation with Moscow. These sanctions prevented Eastern European countries from taking full advantage of their energy resources to revive their economies. The Kremlin and its allies were not only unable to pay for the Cold War expenses, but due to insufficiency of their economies, they totally relied on the revenues earned through selling and transferring natural gas to Western Europe. The Nord Stream 2 project, which is the most important energy project in Europe, has been designed to double the amount of gas that Russia sends to Germany and also bypass Ukraine as a traditional transit route for Russian gas, because it goes through the Baltic Sea. Since the pipeline deprives Ukraine of gas transit revenues and increases Europe's dependence on Russian natural gas, Moscow has been faced with increased resistance from the United States and inside the European Union at a time that Russia is in the midst of a serious face-off with the West.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.